Hi folks. Before we begin, I'm going to play a short promo for the Pax Britannica podcast. It's a podcast on the history of the British Empire, so perfect for those who would like to go further back than the scope covered in this podcast. I'll hand it over to Samuel now.
On a cold January afternoon in 1649, Charles I, King of England, Ireland and Scotland, was executed by his own subjects. His crime? High treason. This unprecedented act rocked the Three Kingdoms and the fledgling British Empire, and followed 10 years of rebellion, revolution, and civil war. Pax Britannica, a history podcast on the British Empire, covers these incredible events, complete with interviews with world-leading experts on the period. Find Pax Britannica everywhere you find your podcasts, or go to pod.link/pax.
Now, back to the podcast. July 1st, 1972. While serving a life sentence for murder, Gusty Spence was granted 6 hours' leave from prison to attend the wedding of his daughter. Spence was one of the founding members of the Ulster Volunteer Force, and he had a loyal and devout following, and in some ways he was the folk hero of loyalism. While outside of prison, Spence attended the wedding, but shortly after he disappeared. It appears he was kidnapped, but not by Republicans. He was in fact kidnapped by his own loyalist paramilitaries. So who exactly was Gusty Spence, and why was he kidnapped? This is the Troubles podcast, a podcast which explores the violence and bloodshed that occurred in Northern Ireland, the Republic of Ireland, and Great Britain, as multiple sides and organisations waged a bloody conflict over the status of Northern Ireland. Augustus Andrew Spence was born on June 28, 1933, on the Shankill Road in West Belfast. His father, William Edward Spence, was from Whitehaven, England, but moved over to Belfast at a young age. William was a member of the Ulster Volunteers, who were mentioned earlier in this season in the episode about Edward Carson. The Ulster Volunteers were a loyalist militia established in 1912, with the aim of preventing self-governance for Ireland. They wanted Ireland to remain a part of the Union with Great Britain. Their efforts were largely interrupted by the outbreak of World War I, and William was one of many who went off to fight for Britain in the war. He returned and married Isabella Hayes in 1919, with the pair having 7 children. I'll be talking about Gusty in this episode, who was the 6th of 7. Gusty Spence joined the Orange Order, becoming a junior Orange man at the age of 8. I touch on the Orange Order frequently. They are a conservative British Unionist Ulster Loyalist group named after William of Orange, who was the King of England beginning his reign in 1689. He was Dutch, and orange is the official colour of the monarchy of the Netherlands. King Billy, as he was known by many Protestants, defeated King James in the Second Battle of the Boyne in 1690, and Protestants believe that this secured the Protestant ascendancy in Ireland. The Orange Order claims to be strictly political, and publicly they have condemned paramilitary violence, but that being said, paramilitary flags were flown at their marches and a number of prominent loyalist paramilitaries were all members of the Order. Anyway, back to Gusty. As a child, Gusty was an excellent student, but his family didn't have much money, and as a result he began working in the mills at a young age. Spence describes the mills as, quote, wet, noisy, greasy. They were filthy and the conditions were absolutely abominable. It was very difficult work, and Spence hated working there. At the age of 16, he left the mills and began working in construction, before moving on to work at the Belfast shipyards. After a few years, work in the shipyard was sparse, so Spence joined the British Army at the age of 25. He served in Cyprus as a military policeman. When he came back to Belfast, he joined the Prince Albert Temperance Loyal Orange Lodge, and this became the epicentre of his social life. It was around this time, 1965, when tensions that had been heating up for years were finally starting to bubble over in Northern Ireland. Gusty was a smart unionist with a military career, and it wasn't long before he was recruited into the Loyalist paramilitary group, the Ulster Volunteer Force. He claims that he was approached by 2 men, one of which was a Unionist MP, and asked to lead the Shankill branch of the UVF. The first attack generally attributed to the UVF was a petrol bomb attack on a Catholic-owned pub on May 7, 1966. The fire spread to an elderly Protestant woman's home, and she was injured in the blaze, eventually passing away from her injuries. A few weeks after the initial petrol bomb attack, the UVF issued a statement announcing themselves to the world, which read, quote, "From this day, we declare war against the Irish Republican Army and its splinter groups. Known IRA men will be executed mercilessly and without hesitation. Less extreme measures will be taken against anyone sheltering or helping them, but if they persist in giving them aid, then more extreme methods will be adopted. We solemnly warn the authorities to make no more speeches of appeasement. We are heavily armed Protestants dedicated to this cause." On May 27, 1966, Spence ordered the killing of IRA member Leo Martin. He dispatched a team to try and find him, but after driving around and failing, they drove up to the predominantly Catholic Falls area of Belfast and shot civilian John Scullion dead as he was walking home. They later claimed that they mistook him for a member of the IRA. Scullion would widely be considered as having the unfortunate title of being the first targeted victim of the Troubles. In later years, Gusty said of the mentality of the time, "The attitude was that if you couldn't get an IRA man, you should shoot a Tighe. He's your last resort." Spence was charged for this murder, but the charges were later dropped. The next attack that Spence was involved in occurred 1 month later, on June 25th, 1966. It was late in the evening when three Catholic barmen who worked at the Old International Hotel in Belfast finished their shifts and went for a drink in a pub near the Shankill Road. As the three men were leaving the pub via the side door, they were greeted by UVF gunmen who'd been waiting outside for them. As a result of this attack, one of the barmen, 18-year-old Peter Ward, died. On October 14th, Spence and two others were convicted for this attack and sentenced to serve 20 years each for their role. Spence continued to maintain his innocence in this attack. He went away to serve his time in Crumlin Road Jail, and to many loyalists on the outside, he had just become a martyr for his beliefs, who argued that there was no case against him and he didn't deserve to go to prison for this attack. They believed he was sentenced for a political reason and that he was an innocent man going away to serve 20 years for the cause of unionism.
"He was reared round here and he's one of us. And he was condemned for something that they never proved he did."
This cemented Gusty Spence in the annals of loyalist history, and he became a folk hero to the people of the Shankill Road. Here's Spence's brother talking when asked why Gusty was such a hero to the people of Shankill.
"I'm the brother of Gusty Spence. He's a bit of a management. He's a wee fella, that type of thing. But Gusty's a popular man. He makes friends very easily, very quickly."
Spence's daughters remember what it was like visiting their father in prison. It was a small room with a table in the centre, with Gusty sitting on one side, a prison officer sitting at the end, and the children sitting at the other end of the table. They were only allowed to talk about certain things that were approved by the prison officer, and they also weren't allowed to have any physical contact with their father. Like Republican prisoners that I've talked about in earlier episodes, Spence saw himself as a political prisoner and not a regular criminal. And as a result, he refused to take part in mandatory prison work. Eventually, a deal was struck where he sat in the tailor's shop of the prison without formally working. While in prison, Spence met with the leaders of other paramilitary groups, including Billy McKee, who was one of the founders of the Provisional IRA, and PJ Mulligan, who was one of the leaders of the Official IRA. They agreed that there would be no conflict in the prisons, and if any one of their members acted out against the other, it would be dealt with internally. In July 1972, the prisoners were eventually granted special category status, which meant that they got to be treated as prisoners of war rather than regular inmates. At the time, special category status was very controversial because some British politicians believed that it undermined the role of the British authorities in maintaining discipline. As a result, it was eventually phased out on March 1st, 1976, which would lead to years of protests from the prisoners and would ultimately culminate in the 1981 hunger strikes, which were covered earlier this season. One of the most bizarre things to happen to Gusty while he was in prison was his abrupt disappearance, which happened 6 years into his sentence. He had been granted 6 hours leave to attend the wedding of his daughter, Elizabeth, to the prominent loyalist Winston Churchill Ray, who went by the nickname Winky. At one stage, Winky was the leader of the secretive Red Hand Commandos, who were a loyalist paramilitary group closely aligned with the UVF. And Winky personally asked Gusty if he could marry his daughter. On July 1st, 1972, Gusty began his leave. Upon leaving the prison, he was met by two members of the Red Hand Commandos, who told him that there was a need for restructuring within the UVF and that Spence was not to return to prison. He ignored this and attended his daughter's wedding, but then afterwards a plan was concocted that saw Spence driven back to jail and then stopped along the way and kidnapped by members of the UVF. Here's one of the kidnappers describing what happened.
He cut off the Springfield Road, leaving up straight up the Spring Garden, and led an ambush there for him. Saw his car coming down with two men on it.
Who was driving?
Mr. Curry. So the papers tell me, anyway. The car came down, we ran the car. And two men went out and lifted Gusty out of the car with a bit of resistance.
And you're saying that that was not an arranged job? You didn't know that that was
going to happen? He didn't know it was going to happen.
Why did you do this?
Well, I think this man here was treated in his trial in 1966. It was a political trial, as far as we were concerned. This man was sentenced for something he didn't do.
Do you think it's really in his interests, though, that this should happen?
Well, if we can get him a retrial, it's in his interest. And the interest of this country.
The outside world had no idea what happened to Spence. Some thought that he was kidnapped and murdered by Republican paramilitaries, whereas others in loyalist areas knew that he was taken in by his own and that he was safe. 1 week after he disappeared, the British investigative TV programme World in Action went in search of Gusty. And they found him. Members of the UVF blindfolded the camera crew and drove them to a secret location, where Spence appeared, surrounded by men in balaclavas as well as one man with a gun. Spence was wearing a military beret and he had sunglasses on as well. He was sitting behind a table with a Union Jack draped over it. He then began answering questions about his current situation, as well as his opinions on the circumstances surrounding the murder that put him in prison in the first place. It's a fairly long interview, but it gives an excellent insight into Spence and his public-facing persona, which often went against the machinations of what was going on in the background.
Mr. Spence, how did you come to be free last weekend? Can you describe the incident?
Well, it was very little to describe. It happened so quickly, and I was bundled from one car into another. At that particular time, I didn't see Jim Curry being struck. I was too busy looking around about me to see who was in the point of apprehending me.
Are you seriously saying that you didn't know that it was going to happen?
Very seriously saying.
Does that mean that you're now being held by the UVF against your will?
Well, I'm being held by the UVF, yes.
Are you being held by the UVF against your will?
Yes, you could say that, yes.
But you are the commander-in-chief of...
No, that's untrue.
You're the chief of staff of the UVF?
No, that's untrue.
You're the leader of the UVF?
That's untrue also.
Although you were lifted without your knowledge, and although you're being held against your will, are you pleased or sorry that you're out of Crumlin Road jail?
I'm pleased. Freedom is God's greatest gift to man. And anyone that would say that he's not pleased to be out of captivity.
So your claim is that you're completely innocent and that you were the victim of a political conspiracy?
It is a claim and it is a fact.
One of the men convicted with you, Hugh McLean,
made
a statement to the police which was used in evidence in court.
Yes.
According to that statement, you and other UVF members had a big drinking session that night and at various pubs, ending up in the Malvern Arms. And into the Malvern Arms that night walked four men with southern accents, including an 18-year-old boy, Peter Ward. And this is what McLean, said in his statement in court. He said, quote, Spence did most of the talking. The conversation came up about the religion of these fellows. Spence went up to the bar beside the four lads to buy a drink. When he returned to our table, he said, I have been listening to the conversation of these fellows, and they are four IRA men. They will have to go. Then these men were shot.
I would say, number one, how does one tell an IRA man and four IRA men did go into a bar? Would they certainly speak about their membership of the IRA? No, I will let the people out there judge me on what they've heard and seen tonight. Whether this statement is true or not. The statement of court used is inadmissible as such. And I let the people be my judge.
Two other people at the trial gave evidence against you as eyewitnesses of the murder. Were they lying too?
Yes, of course they were.
You're saying, if I understand you rightly, that the statements that were made in court naming you were made by people who were part of a political conspiracy against you.
No, what I'm saying is this. I'm saying that Hugh Arnold MacLean had been under interrogation by the Special Branch for two full days. And it has been proven of late the inadmissibility of statements. Statements have been thrown out of the Northern Ireland courts right, left and centre of late. As I said before, 1966 was a bad year for loyalists. And 1966, policemen were given an awful lot of latitude, more than they are being given today.
What's your case for a review of your trial?
It's simple. I feel very, very strongly that I should have been given a separate trial in 1966. During the past 6 years in Crumlin Road Prison, I feel stronger now than ever before that I should get a separate trial, a retrial even, a separate trial.
What do you think your chances are of persuading Mr. Whitelaw to grant a review?
I would think excellent.
Tell me about the formation of the UVF before it was banned.
I can't tell you anything about the formation of the Volunteer Force.
Are you saying that you were not involved in the UVF in 1966?
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I can't tell you anything about the formation of it because I don't know.
Right. Can you tell me how you came to join the UVF in 1966?
Yes, I could tell you, but I won't.
Is it true that you're chief of staff or have been chief of staff?
No, it's completely untrue. Again, it's part of the myth. It's part of the things that go on in people's heads for which I'm not responsible.
What rank do you hold in the UVF?
Again, I won't answer that.
What rank did you hold in 1966?
To repeat myself, I won't answer that.
You would accept, however, that you were a member and played an active part in the UVF?
I would accept that I had an association with the Ulster Volunteer Force, yes.
Just a month before the Malvern Street murder, a message was sent to the Belfast newspapers in the name of the Chief of Staff of the UVF. Perhaps I can remind you of that. It said, from this day on, we declare war against the IRA and its splinter groups. Known IRA men will be mercilessly executed without hesitation. We are heavily armed Protestants dedicated to this cause. Do you remember that statement?
I remember a statement that I'm not too sure of the wording, to be quite frank. But again, as I say, to my knowledge, there is no chief of staff of the Ulster Volunteer Force.
What is the leader of the Ulster Volunteer Force called?
Well, it's a modification jack of what he's called.
But the UVF put out that statement in the name of the organisation.
Someone put out a statement.
Are you now officially denying on behalf of the UVF that statement was made by that organisation?
I'm not in a position to officially deny or confirm any statements put out by the Ulster Volunteer Force.
You see, the UVF is obviously, it's a very mysterious organisation.
True.
People know very, very little about it. What can you tell me about it and about your involvement in it?
What I can tell you is this. The myth was a reality and is a reality.
What differentiates it, for instance, from the UDA or the New Orange Volunteers organisation?
Well, as you can see, where we have seen, we are a militant force, a purely military force, with no allegiance to any particular party.
You've got guns?
Yes.
And you're prepared to use them?
True.
And you have used them?
Yes.
When?
On various occasions.
Against?
Against anyone who would usurp the constitution of Ulster.
You also formed a UVF unit in prison?
There was already an Ulster Volunteer Force unit in Belfast prison.
And you became the leader of that unit?
Being the senior officer, yes.
What kind of contact did your UVF unit in prison have with the movement outside?
We had close contact.
How?
By various ways.
Can you suggest any of the ways?
I could, but I won't.
During the interview, Joe McCann is brought up. McCann was a member of the official IRA, and he was shot dead by the British SAS in 1972. Spence had a lot of respect for McCann, and sent a letter to his widow expressing his sympathy at hearing of his death. It's believed that Spence gained this respect after an incident in which two UVF members were taken captive by the officials, but then released on McCann's orders because they were working class men. This sort of respect for the other side is something we would not see later on in the Troubles. Here's the reporter talking about the letter sent by Spence to McCann's widow.
When the official IRA leader, Joe McCann, was shot dead by British troops only a few weeks ago, you wrote an extraordinary letter to his wife, which I may read to you.
Yes.
You wrote, "My dear Mrs. McCann, I would like to tender to you my deepest and profoundest sympathy on the tragic death of your beloved husband, Joe. There are those who would find it strange to hear from someone such as myself, but I can assure you that whilst your husband and I may have been opposed to each other in politics, we shared that common bond that is known only to those who fight their own respective corners to the best of their ability. He was a soldier of the Republic, and I a volunteer of Ulster, and we made no apology for being what we are or were. I salute your husband as an honourable and brave soldier." You wrote that letter to the wife of an official IRA leader.
True.
That may seem strange to many of your followers and fans on the Shankill Road.
I don't see why. General Erwin Rommel was an honourable soldier, and Field Marshal Montgomery paid him respect. One should not misconstrue the letter. It continues there, where Joe McCann spared the life of two men, spared the lives of two men. That was the good time that was mentioned in the letter. That is the main reason why I wrote the letter.
You refer to the common bond that is known only to those who fight their own respective corners to
yes,
the best
of
their ability. What do you mean by this?
There's
common
a common bond?
Bond.
There's a common bond amongst all soldiers, all honourable soldiers throughout the world, as has been proved since time immemorial. Whenever a flag of truce is hoisted, an honourable man never fares on a flag of truce. It's respected. If we have to fight a war, I say that the war should be fought honourably and to the best of one's ability, but honourably.
During his time at large, Spence was arrested alongside 30 other men at a loyalist drinking club, but after giving a different name, he was released. But eventually, after 4 months on the run, a member of the SAS Parachute Regiment identified Spence by the tattoos on his hand, and he was rearrested and returned to prison to serve out the remainder of his sentence. In the 4 months that Spence was outside of prison, he drew from his experience in the army, and he set about giving a distinct shape to the UVF, structuring it based on Edward Carson's Ulster Volunteers, splitting it up into brigades, battalions, companies, platoons and sections. Spence brought a military discipline to the UVF that hadn't really been seen before. Even considering his past and the reason he was in prison in the first place, Spence was also very opposed to the killing of Catholic civilians, arguing if the UVF was to be considered a military brigade, they could not go around killing random innocent civilians.
Random killing is to be deplored at any time. And I would say that anyone that would do engage themselves in this sectarianism to cease it.
Spence also helped to rearm the UVF, with many arms taken from the security forces, either through theft or collusion. While in prison, Gusty was very well respected, though he was somewhat critical of the UVF on the outside, particularly after the McGurk's Bar bombing, which killed 15 Catholic civilians. In prison, he had a lot of time to reflect on his situation, and he decided he wanted to learn about what led him to be serving this life sentence, and how he got drawn into paramilitary activity. To paraphrase Spence himself, he began reading the autobiography My Fight for Irish Freedom by Dan Breen, which is a story of the man who fired the first shot in the War of Independence in 1919. Over the next few years, he continued to read and gain a larger understanding of the historical context that led to the violence that had been taking place in the mid-60s. In the early years of his sentence, Spence was the commanding officer of all of the Loyalists in prison, both UVF and UDA members. Twice a year, he would allow his members to make poutine, which was a form of alcohol that could be made in the cells. Spence didn't drink it himself, but he used to dry out the poutine and smoke it in his pipe. He was very strict with the men, and had them running military drills and training in weapons use, while also teaching them history and getting them to question why they were in prison. He would have many talks with his fellow prisoners, and even brought up the concept of power sharing in Northern Ireland, decades before it would be introduced. He described it as the politics of the goldfish bowl, and would encourage debate amongst prisoners, introducing different topics every few days. Some of the men loved him and came into prison as radical paramilitaries, but their views gradually changed as a result of him getting them to question their motivations. One individual whose opinion was changed greatly by Spence was David Irvine, who was in prison on violent charges related to loyalism, but upon release he devoted his entire life to politics. Other prisoners weren't happy with his level of discipline and his gradual shift away from violence. One even described him as, quote, the cunt in the cravat. Spence described his view of the union of Northern Ireland and Great Britain as completely unshakable, but he felt that over the past few centuries, there were wrongs which had occurred. He convinced the UVF to call a ceasefire in 1973, but this didn't last long, and they soon resumed their campaign of violence. 1974 was the year in which the Dublin and Monaghan bombings occurred, which killed 34 Irish civilians, the likes of which Spence didn't support at all. According to Spence, after the ceasefire ended, the hard men took over, which I presume means the members of the UVF more committed to violence. On November 11, 1977, Spence publicly resigned from the UVF, though he was to remain closely aligned with them for the rest of his life. Eventually, Gusty Spence was released in 1984 after spending 18 years behind bars. He was released slightly earlier than expected on account of his poor health. Spence recalls the moment he was out in the prison yard exercising, when he was told to go and speak with the governor. The governor said to him, quote, "You have 10 minutes to get out, I'm releasing you." Spence asked if he could take half an hour, saying, "What's 20 minutes here and there after 18 and a half years?" He then said his goodbyes to his friends and he joined up with his family who had been visiting him that day, completely unaware that it was the day he was to be released. Upon his release from prison, Spence decided to devote himself completely to a political solution to the Troubles. He joined up with the Progressive Unionist Party, who were a political party which held ties to the UVF, and he continued to campaign for a peaceful solution to the Troubles. Years later, it was Spence himself who read out the declaration of ceasefire from the Combined Loyalist Military Command on June 13, 1994. This statement went on to offer, quote, "abject and true remorse to the loved ones of the innocent victims of the Troubles." Spence would then later issue another statement in 2007 announcing that the UVF and an associated group, the Red Hand Commandos, would cease in their previous form. He went on to be a supporter of the Belfast Agreement, which is also known as the Good Friday Agreement. He was caught up in the C Company feud in the year 2000, which saw Johnny Adair's C Company attempt to clear the UVF out of Shankill Road so that the UDA could take over. Spence couldn't return to his house on Shankill Road until the violence had passed. One source for this episode is an RT podcast episode which interviewed Spence, where he explained that it was important for unionism to advance with the times. Quote, "There are people within the Unionist Party and within the Unionist population that have to recognise that the old order of things has gone. The predominance has gone, the ascendancy has gone. Working class never had it, so it doesn't affect us, you know. It is gone. And it's left for those to enter the real world as we have. I would not concede that of my Britishness, as soon as I would not concede that of my Irishness, because I am British as well as being Irish. That's the peculiarity. People have to know that you don't have to be anti-Irish to be anti-British. You don't have to be anti-British to be Irish." When asked if he was a hero, this is what Spence had to say.
"On the Shankill, you're regarded as a hero. You're seen as a man who recognised the IRA menace long before the present troubles blew up and took certain actions against that menace. But it seems that those who regard you as a hero and a leader have got it all wrong. You're saying you didn't, in fact, take the actions attributed to you."
"What I'm saying is this. I didn't take the actions with which I was charged. I'm not saying that I didn't take any action. Gusty Spence is a myth. The Gusty Spence, the person that sits before you now, is truly a humble and sincere man. Some people would say, Mr. Rector, that's a matter of conjecture. I am sincere in anything that I have ever done. And I shall be sincere in anything that I shall ever do. As far as the hero bit's concerned, it's nonsense."
Spence died on September 25th, 2011, at the age of 78, after suffering from a long-term illness. He didn't want a paramilitary funeral, or any reference to paramilitarism at his funeral, and he was buried with his coffin draped with the beret and regimental flag of the Royal Ulster Rifles, his former regiment. Brian Irvine said of Gusty Spence, quote, "His contribution to the peace is incalculable, and without him, probably the paramilitaries would still be at war." Sinn Féin councillor Gerry Kelly said that Spence, quote, "was central to the sectarianism that gave birth to the modern loyalist paramilitary. However, he did dedicate himself to peace and reconciliation for much of his later life. So he will also be remembered as a major influence in drawing loyalism away from sectarian strife." During research for this episode, I came across a quote explaining what Gusty did for others when it came to talking to paramilitaries about questioning their motivations. Quote, "Gusty unlocked the door, and he did it for many, and whether you walked through it or not was entirely up to you." That's it from me. Thanks, and see you next time. The Patreon is a great way to show your support. I release the episodes there early, and I also put out a companion video with each episode. On Patreon, the episodes are also completely ad-free, and you can listen on your own personal RSS feed on your podcast player. I'll also be posting there the full show notes for every episode. You can support the podcast over at patreon.com/thetroublespodcast. Alternatively, if you'd like to support the podcast in a once-off fashion, you can do that over at buymeacoffee.com/thetroublespodcast.